Today, the Matt Walsh Show, a record number of Americans now say they want to secede from the union. What explains this trend and where is it leading? We'll talk about that. Also, a Democrat Senate candidate loses her primary and declares the election was rigged against her. Suddenly, it's okay to claim election rigging again, apparently. And the TSA will soon roll out self-checkout security lanes. What could go wrong besides everything? In our daily cancellation, an activist from Brooklyn has just submitted a candidate for the worst poem of the century contest. Yet more evidence that art is dead. We'll talk about all that and more good news today on The Matt Walsh Show. Financial experts thought we were in the clear. While experts anticipated rate cuts, inflation in the United States is still a significant economic concern. Think about it. The U.S. is in the hole by $34 trillion, and yet we keep printing money, which pushes the prices you pay every day even higher. So you can bury your head in the sand or do something about it. Diversify a portion of your savings into gold with Birch Gold Group. Gold is your hedge against inflation, and Birch Gold makes it easy to own. They'll help you convert your existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold. And you're not going to pay a penny out of pocket. Make gold part of your savings strategy and buy it from Birch Gold. They've been the exclusive gold partner of the Daily Wire for over 7 years now, literally helping thousands of listeners, and they can help you too. Text Walsh to 989898 and get your free info kit on gold. Then talk to a precious metal specialist about protecting your savings from persistent inflation with gold. Text Walsh to 989898 now. From a financial perspective, a small commercial and residential district called Buckhead is maybe the single most important neighborhood in all of Atlanta. Taxes from Buckhead pay for roughly 40% of the city's annual revenues, which isn't surprising because it's a relatively affluent area in Georgia. But starting in 2020, like so many other cities, Atlanta chose to demonize police officers. So inevitably, Buckhead became extremely dangerous. Shootouts and carjackings became common, even in broad daylight at the Central Mall. Instead of protecting their cash cow in Buckhead, officials in Atlanta allowed the mob to run rampant, which we all remember all over the country. In response, the residents of the town attempted to do something radical, at least by the standards of modern politics. They tried to secede from the city and establish their own independent government, one that actually respected police officers and paid them well and took care of making people safe and that sort of thing. And the plan nearly worked, but about a year ago, 10 Republican state senators in Georgia joined with Democrats to prevent it from happening. Apparently, there is bipartisan disapproval in Georgia of any proposal that involves enforcing the law. That's one of the few things you can get both Democrats and Republicans to agree on this day, so Buckhead's secession was shot down. Now, at the time, it was easy to dismiss Buckhead's effort as a lark, as the vanity project of a few affluent conservatives living in gated communities in Northwest Atlanta. Indeed, that's what most of the media did, as you would expect. Vox called the idea a product of, quote, the white power structure in Atlanta. Politico mocked the secession effort as mighty. And to the extent that the mainstream left-wing corporate press talked about Buckhead at all, it was to emphasize that the residents of the town are radicals, insurrectionists even, who have nothing in common with most of America. But that wasn't true. As News Nation pointed out, Buckhead was just one of several municipalities throughout the country that were thinking of seceding. Watch.
There are certain communities so frustrated with crime and violence and politics that they are looking at splitting off from whatever city they're part of and creating their own independent communities. One of the largest proposed secessions is in the Greater Idaho Movement. 11 counties in eastern Oregon are attempting to become part of Idaho. Long Island and Staten Island have been pushing to secede from New York City for years. Voters in San Bernardino County approved the proposal that would consider seceding from California. And in Illinois, 27 counties are taking steps to leave the state by passing separation referendums. The latest attempt is coming out of Atlanta, where the wealthiest neighborhood wants to break away from the city.
So it's not just Buckhead, as it turns out. Counties in Long Island, Idaho, Oregon, Illinois, San Bernardino were thinking of doing the same thing. And, you know, it looks like a pattern, but it's one that didn't get much attention at the time. And now we're learning that this pattern is far more widespread than it may have appeared at the time. Researchers at YouGov have found just this week that roughly a quarter of U.S. adults, 23%, currently want their state to secede from the union. Only 51% of respondents opposed secession, while another 27% were unsure. Now, at the state level, the highest percentage in favor of secession was in Alaska, where 36% of adults want out. The next highest is California at 29%, followed by 28% of New Yorkers. Oklahomans are at 28%. Nebraskans, Georgians, Floridians, Washingtonians are not far behind. Now, in a country that had any interest in self-preservation whatsoever, this poll would be leading every primetime television news broadcast. There would be all kinds of experts trying to figure out what could possibly explain these figures and what our elected representatives could do about it. What are the concerns these people have, and how can those concerns be addressed? Because these polls are yet more evidence that Americans have nothing fundamentally in common anymore. We aren't bound by race, creed, or ancestry like people in most other countries are. And in lieu of that, we used to have, you know, shared principles. We used to have a shared basic fundamental belief system that unified us. But we don't have that anymore. We can't even agree that all lives matter, which you'd think would be a pretty basic starting point. We can't agree that only women have babies. We can't agree on basically any fundamental fact of reality. All of that is a source of disagreement. And meanwhile, a major political party demonizes white people as a matter of course. Our politicians seem far more concerned about the sovereignty of foreign states than they care about their own. We are a people from different philosophical universes all crammed together, and that's reflected at every level of our leadership, and it's reflected in every aspect of our culture. But the other reason that secession is so popular is that people feel rightly that the federal government does not have our interests at heart. When the government prioritizes citizens of other countries over our own, people become disenfranchised. There's certainly no sense of loyalty to the federal government. Not that there ever should be a loyalty to the government, but there certainly isn't, as it clearly has no loyalty to us. And maybe no story in the past few days has made that clearer than the murder of Laken Riley, which we've talked about a little bit on the show. She was a 22-year-old nursing student at Augusta University who was jogging on February 22nd at the campus of the University of Georgia. Watch.
The latest in the death of a young woman at the University of Georgia's campus. Investigators with the school's police department announced they have a suspect in custody. They say 26-year-old Jose Antonio Ibarra will face a slew of charges, including malice murder and felony murder. Fox 5's Mary Smith attended a news conference following the arrest. She joins us live from the campus with the details. Mary?
Investigators announced those charges against the suspect, saying they don't believe that he knew the victim in this case. He was taken into custody today, as investigators say the evidence is, quote, robust.
We are obtaining arrest warrants for Jose Antonio Ibarra, 26 years of age. He lives here in Athens, but is not a U.S. citizen.
UGA police have taken Jose Antonio Ibarra into custody in connection with the death of 22-year-old Laken Riley.
As you saw very quickly, the authorities identified that the killer was an illegal immigrant, and that's an important detail, but most of the major media simply ignored it or downplayed it. For example, the Associated Press reported that the killer was a, quote, Athens resident. They also refer to the killer as a 26-year-old man, but they don't report that he is an illegal alien until the seventh paragraph of their story, even though it should be like the first thing they tell us. And that's because they're not interested in talking about the fact that the Biden administration deliberately lets killers like this into the country. As New York Post reported, citing sources at the DHS who spoke to News Nation, the killer of this college student, quote, crossed into El Paso, Texas from Venezuela in September 2022. He had been released due to a lack of detention space. They didn't have space for him. That's the excuse that the feds use now when they don't want to enforce immigration law. They want us to believe that the jails are full of illegal aliens that they're detaining. So many that that they don't even have room for them anymore, which, of course, is complete nonsense. And that wasn't the only opportunity to deport this killer. Again, quoting from the Post, months before Ibarra allegedly killed Riley, he was apparently arrested in New York for endangering a child. Police sources in New York confirmed a man by the same name and age as the Georgia suspect was arrested in the Big Apple last year after allegedly endangering the welfare of a five-year-old. In other words, The murder of Laken Riley was maybe the single most preventable crime that has ever occurred in the history of the state of Georgia. All the feds had to do was enforce the law at any point in the past 2 years and throw this degenerate killer out of the country, and this never would have happened. But they didn't do that. Why not? The mayor of Athens, Kelly Gertz, has offered something of an explanation. Instead of apologizing to the family of Laken Riley or explaining why authorities didn't enforce immigration law, the mayor proceeded to deliver a lecture about Donald Trump and the importance of treating migrant killers with the dignity they supposedly deserve. This is truly one of the most repulsive press conferences you'll ever see. Here's part of it.
Humanity is the expectation of human dignity. While 2019 was not that long ago, you might remember the dynamic we were living in the late teens in this country, where you had the President of the United States speaking in the most vile terms about people who were foreign born. And you had that notion metastasizing in places like Charlottesville.
This is an invasion! When I was younger,
so when we have,
I was a criminal. And you know what I thought about doing? Crossing the border to Mexico to get away from my crimes.
Son, I'm going to ask you to leave.
Jesus Christ, he saved me, and I no longer live that lawless life. But you do.
Son, I'm going to ask you to leave.
You are lawless, Mr. Mayor.
I'd be glad to schedule some time with you if you'd like some individual time.
Yeah, I'd like to spend some time with you.
Let's do that, but I need to continue.
I got a question.
Sorry.
Are you going to assume the resolution, is that still in place? Does that give the impression this is a sanctuary city?
What,
no, you can't call it that under Georgia law?
What we wish to do is dignify everybody's humanity. There's nothing in that resolution
that
creates
the law. You took an oath to uphold the law, not your feelings nor your opinion.
We have to dignify everyone's humanity. Well, I don't know about you, but I would say that when you murder an innocent woman, then you have undignified your own humanity, whatever the hell that even is supposed to mean. But this was his primary concern. You know, somebody is dead, and his primary concern is that we don't say anything mean about illegal immigrants. And these are the kinds of people that are running the country and running states and running cities. It's the exact kind of thinking that has festered for many years in this country. It's why women like Laken Riley are dead today. At every opportunity, even when they're confronted with murdered college students, politicians like Kelly Gertz insist that the problem isn't with policy. They claim that the real problem is rhetoric. People like Donald Trump are too mean to Mexicans, apparently. You're supposedly too xenophobic and uncultured to understand what's really happening. But as the bodies pile up, that position is becoming completely untenable. It's always been untenable, but it's becoming more and more obviously untenable to normal people. Jason Rantz reported last night that an illegal immigrant who just killed a Washington State trooper by getting intoxicated and hitting the trooper on the side of the road was previously arrested in a domestic violence case several years ago. Rantz reports that authorities suspected this person was in the country illegally, but they couldn't act. Here's what Rantz reported, quote, 2 days after Washington Governor Jay Inslee signed Democrat sanctuary state legislation into law, Raul Benitez Santana, who's accused of killing a Washington State trooper on a state highway last Saturday, accepted a plea agreement for a domestic violence incident years earlier. He was in the country illegally at the time. Court documents indicate officials may have or should have suspected his status as an illegal immigrant. But because Washington State was a sanctuary for illegal aliens, the authorities couldn't do anything with that information. They had to allow this domestic abuser to stay in the country, where ultimately he would murder a state trooper. Which was inevitable, by the way, that even if he didn't kill a state trooper, that like he's just going to do worse and worse things until someone ends up dead. And by the way, even after this illegal alien killed that state trooper, the local media still ran cover for him, just as they ran cover for the murder of Laken Riley. For example, here's how the local station, KOMO, reported the story of the state trooper's death. Quote, trooper killed in three-vehicle I-5 crash identified, Linwood man in custody. Not illegal alien, not domestic abuser. Instead, he's a Linwood man, just like Laken Riley's killer was an Athens resident. The corporate press will do everything they can to run cover for killers, at least as long as those killers are foreigners in this country illegally and as long as they're killing white people. Their calculation is that people will shut up and take all this in the name of tolerance. Whatever their motivation is, whether they just want to ensure their political survival, whether they want to bring about demographic replacement or both, that's not really the most important thing. As a practical matter, the effects of these policies are finally proving to be far too destructive for most Americans to tolerate. As illegal aliens continue to indiscriminately murder American citizens, from college students to state troopers and everybody in between, more and more people are looking to Buckhead as a model. And that doesn't mean that they'll secede necessarily. But it does mean that for the first time since the Civil War, millions of Americans are thinking about it. Now let's get to our five headlines. Keeping windshields clean is always a pain, especially with all the rain we've been getting here in Nashville. That's why I am so grateful to have Windshield Wow. Windshield Wow is an innovative windshield cleaning device that uses two magnetic cleaning paddles, one on the outside and one on the inside of your car, to clean both sides of your windshield, all from the outside. Being able to clean both the front and the inside window at the same time is a game changer. I wish I had one of these years ago. Windshield Wow applies firm cleaning pressure. It's super thin to get into those tight dashboard areas. All you got to do is push around the outside paddle, and the inside follows automatically, leaving your windshield squeaky clean. What's awesome about Windshield Wow is how easy it is to throw these in the back of your car. And, you know, you always have it there. Think about how much we're in our car from daily commutes, road trips, bird droppings, tree sap, and more. Windshield Wow is always here to save the day. Washing your car windshield enhances visibility and driving safety and also helps preserve the integrity of your vehicle's glass and paintwork. It's a simple yet essential aspect of car maintenance that shouldn't be overlooked. So what are you waiting for? Go to windshieldwow.com. Use code Walsh to check out for a special discount. That's windshieldwow.com. Using code Walsh. Mediaite reports Representative Katie Porter, Democrat, suggested on Wednesday that the California U.S. Senate election had been rigged after she fell 20 points behind Democratic rival Representative Adam Schiff and Republican candidate Steve Garvey. She wrote, quote, "Thank you to everyone who supported our campaign and voted to shake up the status quo in Washington. Because of you, we had the establishment running scared, withstanding 3-1 in TV spending and an onslaught of billionaires spending millions to rig the election." She continued, "It's clear Californians are hungry for leaders who break the mold, can't be bought, and push for accountability in government and across our economy. And that's exactly what we as Americans deserve. Special interests like politics as it is today, because they control the politicians, blah, blah, blah. But I'll never stop fighting." And I mean, she lost, but that's what she's saying. And Porter echoed these sentiments when she conceded the race in a speech. Let's watch some of that.
"Our opponents threw everything. Every trick, millions of dollars, every trick in the playbook to knock us off our feet. But I'm still standing in high heels. The most important thing I want to say tonight is thank you. Because of you, we had the establishment running scared. Yeah. Withstanding 3-1 in TV spending and an onslaught of billionaires who spent millions peddling lies, and our opponent spending more to boost the Republican than promoting his own campaign. You gotta be kidding. I want to thank each and every one of you, really, each and every one of you, for the support that you have shown me in this campaign and over the years."
I'm still standing in high heels, she says. And I really want to know what political consultant has told these female politicians that these kinds of lines work. Because every female politician does it. Like, is there any female politician in America who hasn't used a version of that line yet? They love throwing the high heels line in. I can do that, and I can do it in high heels. I want to know, find me one. Find me a female politician who hasn't, like, referenced her high heels in a sassy way. Is there one? Someone has convinced these ladies that this line, like, kills, but I see no evidence of that. And it especially doesn't really make sense in the context of losing. Like, she says she's still standing, but she's not. You know, you lost. You got blown out. And she says she has the establishment running scared, but she doesn't. You lost by 20 points. I don't think anyone's running scared. Oh, we got him right where we want him now. And also, Katie Porter is the establishment. And even if she wasn't, nobody in the establishment is looking at Katie Porter and going, oh, man, that's Katie Porter. Well, look out for her. She's terrifying. And she wears high heels. That's not happening. But more to the point here, of course, is that and the thing that's gotten more attention, deservedly so, is that Porter, a Democrat again, claimed that the election was rigged against her. Okay, and in this case, the election rigging happened because donors gave money to her opponent and not to her. Because you know, if they had offered her the money, she would have turned it down, right? She would have said, "Oh no, I can't take it. That's election rigging. Oh, you want to give me $50 million? I can't. No, thank you. No, sir. I'm not taking that. Get those millions of dollars out of my face. I will throw it on the ground and stomp on it in my high heels." I'm sure that would have happened, right? You know, all these, you know, let me just say right now, as a general rule, every politician who complains about big donors is full of every single one. And I'll tell you why. Because none of them would turn down the money if it was offered to them. None of them would. You find me the one that was offered big money and said, don't want it, not going to take it. So they're all just every time, like, and I hope that everyone understands that every time you hear the big donors, get the big donors out of here. Like, the big donors you hate are the ones who aren't giving you money. Those are the ones you don't like, but the ones that give you money, you're fine with them. So we see again that election rigging claims are totally par for the course. Democrats do it all the time. I mean, this has been absolutely commonplace and basically a perfunctory response to losing an election since at least Bush v. Gore, you know, in 2000. That's you know, essentially every presidential election that I have watched and been aware of. I was like 13 or so during Bush Gore, and that was kind of the first presidential election I sort of paid attention to. And every single one since then, every election since then, at every level, there's been somebody loses and they say the election's rigged. And sometimes they claim it validly. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's a mix. But the point is that after 20 years of this, suddenly the media pretends that Trump is the first political candidate to ever claim that an election was illegitimate. That's the biggest farce of all when it comes to this whole thing and all the outrage against Trump for insurrection and he won't concede and he won't admit that he lost. All these things we hear from the media. What makes it so farcical is that this is what this you're acting like you've never heard this before. And not only is it common, but it is more common among Democrats. And in fact, I should probably rewind and say that for like two decades, Democrats were like the only ones who said that. So not only is it more common among them, but they were the only ones saying that. The only difference is that most of the time when every time when the Democrats claimed the election was rigged against them, it was false. All right. And we know that it's false, by the way, because the systems of power and the institutions all want the Democrats to win. So no one's rigging anything against you. And as far as Katie Porter in a Democrat primary, you know, they don't, it's like the big money donors, the system, the establishment, they don't care. They'll take Adam Schiff or Katie Porter. They don't have a preference. Yeah, I mean, I guess they chose Adam Schiff, they gave him the money, but they're not going to, I mean, could they rig an election to make sure that Katie Porter loses? They could. Do they need to? No. Because if she won, that'd be fine with them. They can buy her just as easily. Doesn't matter. She's totally on board with their agenda. It makes no difference. All right. Some innovations are coming to your local TSA. Something to be excited about. Let's watch this.
It's been 23 years since TSA was stood up. Today, screening 2.5 million people every day at 440 airports nationwide. Every carry-on, every suitcase, every passenger screened and cleared. But now the TSA is testing what could be a faster checkpoint of the future.
It was great. Quick. No hassle.
A self-checkpoint. Much like self-grocery checkouts, almost the entire screening process is self-guided. More automated, allowing TSA officers to keep eyes on security.
What did you think?
I liked it. I think it's a lot easier.
But it's not gone without hiccups. Gloria from New York was rushing to catch a flight.
It took me 4 or 5 minutes to get through.
What was the hang-up?
Supposedly my watch, my hair clip. My jacket.
Starting today, a 6-month trial run in Las Vegas, reserved for pre-check flyers only who know the routine.
Some of this will be familiar to regular travelers. Come up to the checkpoint, take your carry-on, put it in the bin. If you've got any questions, simply ask the TSA officer on demand.
Hi there, how may I help you today?
TSA officers will dial in remotely.
Place everything in the bin. Yes, and when you're all done, go ahead and slide your items forward.
Slide your bin onto the rollers, then walk right into the full body scanner. And this is what's new. You come in and you put your arms down to the side, and it's going to look for anything that shouldn't be there. And it's telling me I got to come back out. I have a microphone, of course, that it's detected. I've got the transmitter on my belt, And something a lot of people forget, my cell phone.
Bags that require rescreening cycle right back automatically.
Well, that's not creepy at all. So now you walk into the scanner and it closes behind you and you're trapped in a metal box, in a glass box, rather. I mean, this is the worst idea that TSA has come up with since it had the idea to exist in the first place. Just imagine the nightmare this is going to be. I can't even, like, think about being stuck. Like, think about it this way. Think about being stuck behind the person in a self-checkout, you know, lane at the grocery store. The person who has decided to self-scan an entire grocery cart full of groceries, despite apparently having no idea how any of it works. They have no concept. They don't know how to scan. They don't know. They have a produce, you know, they pull out a green pepper and it's like, it's a crisis. They don't know what, they don't know. I mean, even though there are pictures like press here for produce and they don't, they're looking at the thing. They have no clue. They start looking under it to see if there's, so that scenario, but amplified by a million, is what we're talking about if you do this at TSA. Because now you have an endless stream of travelers who are confused and flustered, trying to dial in to the remote TSA call center person, who, by the way, will have an even worse attitude than the normal TSA people when they're there in person. So that was totally fanciful. What we just saw with, you know, you have the TSA call center and she was sitting there and she's all, you know, happy and very patient. Oh, we'll do that and do this. She's very happy. She'll walk them through it. But we know that it's like, who are the most surly groups of people that you encounter as a customer? One, TSA agents, you know, they're maybe number one, or maybe number two. And then number one are call center employees. So those are the two groups have the worst attitude. And now you're going to combine them. Now you're going to put them together into one. And those are the people that we're going to be dealing with. And that if you have an issue as you're trying to get through self-checkout at the airport now, that's the person you got to. And think about how many fail points there are along the way. Because when you, that's the other problem. You automate everything. Everything's computers. And then there are so many different failed. There are so many different places where this can get screwed up. And not only where it could get screwed up, but it could get screwed up in a way that nobody on the premises knows how to fix. Okay, so the screen goes down and you can't contact the TSA person to get help. What do you do then? Okay, the whole system breaks down. You go into the self-scanner thing. It doesn't work. What do? You get stuck. The glass doors won't open. There's someone stuck in there. That's going to be the next horror story. We've heard about people getting stuck on, you know, if you get stuck on the tarmac for 2 hours. Now we're going to have stories of people getting stuck inside the scanner for 4.5 hours. That's what's going to happen. It's going to be so bad. We're going to be at the point now where if you have a flight on Wednesday, you need to get to the airport on Monday morning in order to have any chance of making it to your flight on time. And besides that, you've also now officially just embraced the fact that TSA is nothing but security theater. It's not actual security. I mean, that's been the case the entire time, obviously, because if somebody wants to sneak something through, it's not that hard to do already. But, and many of us have had the experience of accidentally sneaking things through. You know, you get through security, and then you look in your bag, and you're like, oh, I have a massive pocket knife in my bag. I had no... Okay, well, all right, I guess I'm bringing this on the plane. They didn't know. Not that I'm saying I've ever done that, to be clear. It's probably a federal crime. I've never done that myself. I never would, but I've heard stories of people making it through security with things that definitely you're not supposed to have on the airplane anymore. And so it's always been that way, and now it's even more that way. Because the one advantage of the TSA from a security perspective, if they're, like, in theory, the one advantage of the TSA is that you have human beings, supposedly trained people who are there and can observe and hopefully spot any suspicious behavior. And they can do it in a way that again, in theory, only people can do, because people can read other people in a way that computers cannot. And they've proven inept at doing that. But now if you go to the self-checkout option, that's not even a possibility. So, you know, of course the answer is just get rid of the entire thing. Because do you know why? You know why there hasn't been an attack, a terrorist attack on a plane since 9/11? You know why there hasn't been one? I'll tell you why. because nobody has tried. But that's the actual reason. I mean, a few people have tried. They're the shoe bomber, right? It was the underwear bomber. And those were both decades ago now. But they botched that on their own. They weren't caught by TSA. So for the most part, it hasn't happened because, like, nobody has wanted it to make it happen. No one has put the effort in to blow up a plane, thank God. And because, you know, mostly there are few terrorist attacks because there just aren't that many terrorists out there trying to perpetrate attacks against us. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm not saying it's not, a plausible risk, but it's just not common. Like, it just isn't common. There aren't. And you know that's true because, yes, there's security at the airport. Security that you can easily, like, it's not that hard. Everybody knows what the security is. And if you are an even mildly sophisticated terrorist, you could figure out a way to get around it. This is not Fort Knox. But also, I mean, look, you know, the Amtrak, for example, I was on the Amtrak recently. Anyone can board the Amtrak with a bomb. No problem. There's not anything stopping you. So, which also doesn't make it, not that I want TSA at Amtrak now also, but it also just makes no sense. Like, the federal government has this intense focus on airplanes, and yet you on a train, you can put a bomb in the backpack, you just walk right on. It's like nobody will know. There's nothing stopping you. So how does that make any sense? It's like we think that that's the planes are the only place a terrorist would ever go. And yet you don't, for the most part, in this country, very often, thank God, see these kinds of things on trains either, but just because it's rare. So it's an extreme rarity. And my only point of bringing that up is that, you know, the TSA wants to give itself credit, and the government generally wants to give itself credit because they want to say, well, look, you know, since 9/11, there hasn't been a successful terrorist attack on a plane. No, look at that. We've got almost 25 years terrorist attack free on planes. Well, yeah, but you get no credit for that. You just don't get any credit for it. It's not because of you. It's that the TSA is not out there foiling terrorist plots left and right. Okay? That's what, if it happened, they would tell us. If there was somebody with a suicide vest trying to get on a plane and the TSA stopped them, they would tell us. We would know about it. They don't tell us about it because it doesn't happen. You know, and what we do know is that when the bad guys get it into their head that they want to perpetrate some terrible attack somewhere, the government actually is totally inept at stopping them. It's like whenever they decide they want to do it, they can do it. And it happens in those occasions. And especially if this is how we are going to handle it now. Okay. Daily Mail has this. Here's the headline. How an anti-anxiety drug, which is currently prescribed to more than 8 million Britons, is linked to nearly 3,400 deaths in the past 5 years. An anti-anxiety drug, reading now from the article, which is prescribed to more than 8 million people in Britain, has been linked to thousands of deaths in the past 5 years. It has been revealed. Concerns have been raised about the impact of pregabalin? Pregabalin? I don't know. Which is used by doctors to treat anxiety as well as epilepsy and nerve pain, with one saying prescribing it is like selling a car without brakes. Use of the drug can lead to dependency, with some people becoming addicted to the euphoria that taking it can cause, while others become reliant on the relaxed feelings it can induce. Those who have become addicted to it have compared it to trying to wean themselves off morphine and oxycodone, two drugs notorious for the ill effects they have on people who try to quit. Pregabalin users have told Mail Online that the drug has led to erratic behavior, blurred vision, mood swings, and suicidal thoughts, with many now desperate to lower their dosage or come off the medication that has robbed them of their lives altogether. It's been linked to nearly 3,400 deaths in Britain in the past 5 years alone. The drug involved in 779 fatalities in 2022, up from just 9 a decade earlier in 2012. So there's been a few reports about this drug that I've seen recently. And all of the reports have focused on its prevalence overseas. I don't know how prevalent it is here in the United States, but and this is just you know, this just the latest psychiatric drug that we're hearing about that have terrible side effects. And this is why, you know, people accuse me of being anti-psychiatric drugs. And I'm not, you know, because anti would mean that I'm taking the position that you should never prescribe it to anybody, that all psychiatric drugs are bad in all circumstances and they should never be prescribed to anybody under any circumstance. That's not my position. That's not my position. My position is that, well, number one, there are way too many of these drugs, way too many, and they're given out far too easily. Now, the difference, and that part, you know, when I say that, almost everybody would agree, even the people that are on these drugs, even people that are on a cocktail of psychiatric drugs. When they hear that, they'll go, oh, yeah, it's way overprescribed. You know, except the problem is that it's like it's way overprescribed, and everybody who it's been prescribed to will agree that it's way overprescribed, except that everyone who it's been prescribed to will say that it should have been prescribed to them. So that's the interesting thing. It's overprescribed, but we're not willing to look at any individual case and say, oh yeah, that person should not have gotten it. It's a strange thing, isn't it? When we all agree these drugs are overprescribed, but there's not any individual person who shouldn't have gotten it who did, apparently. Because if you ever try to get more specific, this is where I run into trouble with people. When you get more specific and you say, okay, well, here are some kinds of cases where I don't think they should give these drugs out. Then all the people who agree it's overprescribed are go, oh, what? What are you, a doctor? You can't say that. I thought you just agreed that it's overprescribed. So can we get past that part of the conversation, start talking about like the scenarios when we should not be giving these drugs out? So when I say that it's overprescribed, I mean that, I don't mean it in the sense that, five million people are on a certain drug and it should only be 4.5 million or something. I don't mean it in that sense. I mean in the sense that 5 million people, just pulling a number out at random, 5 million people are on a certain psychiatric drug, but it should only be like 500 people who are on it. Okay, that's what I mean by overprescribed. I mean that these drugs, there's a certain portion of these drugs that really just should not be on the market at all. And of the ones that have a valid application, it should be used in an absolute worst case scenario. And worst case scenario as in no other methods are effective and it's the only way to stop someone from doing something drastic, destructive, or self-destructive. In that case, as a temporary last resort band-aid measure, I can see a scenario where you use psychiatric drugs. And those kinds of situations do happen, where you've got someone and they're in a state of total self-destruction. And then, you know, you do whatever you have to do in that moment. It's like, you know, I don't think that we should be going around, like if someone is depressed, we shouldn't go and tackle them to the ground and drag them off to somewhere to get treatment. However, if somebody's on the edge of a building and is about to jump, then in that case, when it's your only option, then yeah, you run up and you tackle them. And then you end up probably, hopefully taking them somewhere to get, whether they want to or not, taking them somewhere to get the help they need. And I kind of look at psychiatric drugs the same way. And that's how I think everyone should look at them. That's how I think the medical field should look at them. That's how they should be used. That's how they were originally meant to be used. Not as like a daily thing that millions of people take for their whole lives. And not as a first resort, which is the other problem. They become a first resort. Someone comes in, they're struggling with anxiety. 5 seconds later, they got the prescription in their hand. And not for anyone who's dealing with basically the normal challenges of being a human being in the world. And that's why when I read about anxiety drugs in particular, now once again, there could be people who are basically crippled totally dysfunctional, unable to function, or they feel like they are, living completely self-destructive lives, on the verge of again, doing something drastic potentially. And maybe in that case, some of these anti-anxiety drugs could have a place. But generally speaking, this is, you know what it's used? It's like maintenance. They give these drugs out as maintenance for people. People are just, you know, experiencing anxiety. Everybody does. Oh, my anxiety is different. Eh, probably not. You think it is because it's yours and you only have your own anxiety. You can't really compare it to anybody else. But so you don't really know that. But, you know, most people, it's just sort of like baseline anxiety that everybody has all the time. And it's hard to deal with. Like, it's hard to be a person sometimes. But those are all of those kinds of cases. They should not be giving these drugs out. And yet they do. And it doesn't matter how many of these headlines we see, people overdosing, dying, side effects. It only gets worse and worse. And that's because, you know, we always hear about difficult conversations we should be having. And I kind of hate that phrase now. We need to have a difficult conversation. I hate the phrase, but in this case, this is actually a difficult conversation that we should be having as a society about mental illness and about these drugs that everybody's taking, and that every individual person taking it thinks they need it, when in reality, most of them don't. That's a difficult thing for people to hear, but they need to hear it. Let's get to Was Wall Strong. Are you struggling with back taxes or unfiled returns this year? The IRS is escalating collections by adding 20,000 new agents. In these challenging times, your best defense is to use Tax Network USA. Along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. These guys are not your friend. Don't waive your rights and speak to these agents on your own. Tax Network USA, a trusted tax relief firm, has saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best deal possible. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help. Whether it's businesses or personal taxes, whether you have the means to pay or you're on a fixed income, Tax Network USA can help finally resolve your tax burdens once and for all. Seize control of your financial future now and don't let tax issues overpower you. Contact Tax Network USA for immediate relief and expert guidance. Call 1-800-245-6000 or visit tnusa.com/walsh. Turn to Tax Network USA and find your path to financial peace of mind. That's tnusa.com/walsh. We haven't done this segment in a few days, so of all the topics we've discussed in the last several shows, the one that's gotten the most negative reaction from the audience by far is the one about the young mother at a bar who got cussed out for having her baby with her. And I explained that the older woman who cussed her out and told her to leave and that she shouldn't have her baby in the bar was in the wrong. And I explained that bars obviously come in different forms. There are bars that it would be inappropriate to bring a child to, obviously, but most bars these days are bar and grills, you know, bar and restaurant. Most bars serve food. They very often have kids menus, and you know, they give out crayons to kids. And that's what type of, and in those kinds of bars, which again is most of them, obviously you could bring a kid. And that appears to be the sort of bar that this woman was in. And so obviously the older woman was not only wrong for the way she handled it, but was also wrong on the merits of the case. And I thought I made it clear that my position on this topic is just right, and no other opinion is even valid. And yet still, there are people who are disagreeing with me. I can't understand it. Like I already told you. Didn't you hear me? I said that I'm right. So that should be enough, but it's not. So we'll read a few of these. Kids have their place and there are places for adults only. Always been like that and it's always the way it should be. There are things, times, and places they should only participate in when they reach a certain age. Simple as that. They live in an adult's world and need to wait till grown up. While the drunk lady was gross and ridiculous, you really went overboard. This is another comment. Adults want playtime at Chuck E. Cheese. You're passionate about the subject because you have small children. I was too when my children were young. There's nothing wrong with wanting a quieter environment at dinner. So you go to a bar? That's the quieter environment you want? Another comment says, guess I'm a serial killer because I don't think you should bring a baby to a bar, LOL. Maybe the messenger was a little crazy, but really, are we surprised that a drunk person accosted her at a ready-for-it bar? LOL, drunk person at a bar, no way. Finally, no, Matt, drinking beer, especially as a so-called Christian, is morally wrong. Bringing kids into a den of sin is just wrong. Now, if it's a restaurant that also has a bar, there's some nuance, but just a straight-up bar, no, and you should be ashamed. A den of sin. You know, sir, that is one way. That's a strong way to refer to Applebee's, I have to say. Now, I know not everybody likes Applebee's, but I happen to be an Applebee's apologist. I think calling it a den of sin is a bit overboard. Okay, you know, in terms of Christians shouldn't drink beer, I hate to repeat myself, but you're just wrong about that. And this is fine. You know, I know that there are some denominations, there are some Christian communities that feel strongly about this, that Christians should never drink and that drinking is morally wrong. And I don't, you know, it's not a big deal. Like, you can be wrong about that. It doesn't hurt you much to be wrong about it. But you are obviously wrong. And in fact, it's from a theological perspective, from a biblical perspective, it's one of the more wrong interpretations of the Bible you can have, because Jesus is like, we actually get in terms of length and how much we are told, we aren't told a whole lot about Jesus's life, certainly not his life prior to his public ministry. We get almost nothing about that. We get, you know, the infancy narrative, and then we get one brief scene when he was an adolescent, and then we get his public ministry. So we get nothing of Jesus's life almost until his public ministry. And then in the public ministry, it's not a lot. There's not a lot of information that we're given. And, you know, if you were to take all the Gospels and sort of synthesize them and put everything, you know, you can buy, like they call it a parallel Gospel, where they put all the kind of the Gospel stories together to get the whole narrative. And it's a short book, is my point, okay? And yet, in spite of that, in spite of the fact that we're given very little, there's not a lot that we need to know, you know, there are, you know, several crucial details that are in there. And in spite of that, we are still told about Jesus not only consuming alcohol, but using it multiple times in his miracles, including the first miracle of his public ministry, which was the wedding at Cana. And that first miraculous event was him providing alcohol to a party, if you may recall, as recounted in the Gospel of John. So to see that and then to come away with the conclusion that drinking alcohol is fundamentally, inherently morally wrong is absurd. You know, I'm not going to call it blasphemous. You could argue that it is, because you're accusing Jesus of engaging in an inherently immoral act. But I won't say that, because I know that that's not really what you're saying, because you have this tortured, totally invented, ad hoc, arbitrary interpretation where you've just decided that the alcohol he's using is non-alcoholic. It never says that anywhere. You've just included that. You say, well, it must be non-alcoholic because I don't personally like alcohol. It's not what it says. It says wine. And since the invention of wine, in no culture has wine meant a non-alcoholic substance. So I didn't want to spend a long time on that, but I did, because I just find it, I do find it irritating. And you know why? Because it's also so unnecessary. You don't need to do that. If you don't personally like alcohol, great. And if you say, I don't want to drink it, I don't want it around me, that's great. I totally respect that. And there's nothing unchristian about that, obviously. And so just say that. Just say, it's not for me. I don't want it. I don't want it in my life. And great. But you don't have to try to extrapolate it into a thing that all Christians are required to follow, into a moral edict that apparently Jesus himself fell short of. As for the rest of this, I don't know. I guess I've already covered it. I will only reiterate two things, aside from the fact that there are different kinds of bars. And yes, if you bring your kid to a college bar, you bring your kid to some sort of dive bar, to a biker bar, to those kinds of bars, then that would be crazy. But people don't do that. I've been in those kinds of bars plenty of times in my life. I've never seen a baby in any of those kinds of bars. That's not where people bring. Why would you bring a baby? Like, nobody would. Well, I don't want to say nobody. There are plenty of bad parents out there, but it's just not. I don't see it. I've never seen it. Maybe you have. I haven't. But most of these places are just places where people eat and they also drink, and it's okay to bring kids. But I guess the main point to reiterate is that, again, I don't think, this first comment says, oh, there are places that are just for adults. We need to have the adult places. Sure, yeah, of course there are places that are just for adults. But the sort of tone of these comments makes it sound like we live in a culture where you just can't go anywhere without being bothered by kids. You just can't go anywhere. Everywhere you go, there's kids running all over the place. And that's not the case. I mean, if it's important to you to avoid being around kids, then it's really easy to do, even if you want to go out to eat. Look, I don't mind. I have six kids. Obviously, I don't mind being around kids. We go to places all the time where there are kids all over the place. But yeah, if I'm going out to a date night with my wife, and it's 7 o'clock on a Friday night, we like to go to a quieter place. We like to go to a quieter place where it's adults like quietly enjoying a meal. It's really easy to find places like that. Because the thing is, too, that those kinds of places, they're more expensive and they're quiet. And so if you're a parent, that's the last place you want to bring a kid. No parent is looking for a fancy, expensive, quiet place to bring their kids. No parent's looking for that. So it's easy, very easy to find those kinds of places if you want to. And everywhere else, I think it is on us as people to be welcoming of children and of families and to make them feel welcome. There's something magical about reliving old family films. As I sit down and press play, I'm transported back in time. The flickering images on the screen are more than just recordings. They're reminders of how I became the man I am today. Thanks to Legacy Box, I can access these precious memories at the touch of a button. You can relive your memories. Also, create your Legacy Box filled with camcorder tapes, film reels, and pictures. You'll get digital copies that are easily enjoyed, shared, and organized. It's like magic. Legacy Box is the world's largest digitizer. They've helped over 1 million families relive their wedding days, chaotic childhood sporting events, and even those long road trips. And by going to legacybox.com/Matt, you can enjoy 50% off. But you have to hurry because this offer, it's not going to last long. Go to legacybox.com/Matt to save 50% for a limited time only. That's legacybox.com/Matt. Again, that's legacybox.com/Matt. Tonight, join the Daily Wire backstage as Ben Shapiro, Michael Knowles, Andrew Klavan, the God King himself, Jeremy Boring, and myself watch and react to the 2024 State of the Union live on Daily Wire Plus. I'm a big fan of the State of the Union. I love watching it. I have so much to say about it. I have so much analysis to offer. I'm just, when you get me going on the State of the Union, man, you'll never stop me. So I got so much interesting to say about this really fascinating event. It's an experience you are not going to find anywhere else. You can watch it all live tonight at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on the Daily Wire app and dailywire.com. Now let's get to our daily cancellation. Well, I should tell you that I actually had other plans for the daily cancellation today, but then this morning I happened to see something pop up on my Twitter feed that was so bad and lame that I had no choice but to change course. So someone named Vinay Krishnan, who describes himself as a writer, organizer, and attorney living in Brooklyn, decided to share something that he calls poetry. And apparently Vinay fashions himself a poet on top of all of his other self-ordained titles. This particular piece of poetry, I'm sad to report, has at this moment 20,000 retweets and 2 million views. There are hundreds of comments saying things like this, quote, "This is heartbreaking and lovely," end quote. "I would have cried reading this, but I'm just too tired to cry," end quote. "It's fantastic and breaks my heart at the same time." And also, quote, "I've been waiting for a poem like this, whether from me or someone else." So that's what the people are saying. Some people at least are saying that it's lovely, beautiful, heartbreaking. It's the poem we've been waiting for. It's the poem of the ages, the poem of our time. And it's also easily the most popular poem posted to Twitter in quite some time, which perhaps isn't saying much, but another accolade to add to the list. Certainly, you would hope that for a poem to be viewed so many times and for it to be reposted by so many people and for it to receive such glowing reviews, for it to reduce readers to tears of joy and sorrow, it must be quite powerful. Well, let's find out. Here's the poem from Vinay Krishnan, the organizer from Brooklyn. It's titled, "There's Laundry to Do and a Genocide to Stop." So things are not starting off very strong based on the title, but let's not judge a poem by its title. Let's venture on unafraid. We must be brave. We must be courageous. And here's the poem. "There's laundry to do and a genocide to stop. I have to eat better and also avoid a plague. My rent went up $150. I'll need to pick up more shifts. 20 people died in Rafah this morning, and every major news outlet is stretching the limits of passive voice to suggest whole families may have leaped up through the air at missiles that otherwise had the right of way. I just got a notification that my student loan payments are starting up again, and my phone isn't charged. My cousin got COVID for a fourth time and could no longer work or walk or even feed himself. The person across from me on the L train seems to fashion themselves a punk rock revolutionary, but they're not wearing a face mask. And that's the kind of cognitive dissonance that makes me want to steal batteries. Fascists keep winning primaries for both parties, and I think I gained a few pounds. The CDC just announced there are no more speed limits on highways, and I think this Ativan is finally hitting. This NYPD farmer's market only sells bad apples. Have you heard that one? Listen, it's warm today. Too warm for March. But I don't have time to think through the implications because there's laundry to do and a genocide to stop." The end. There's the poem. I mean, once again, as always, I've made it way too good with my stirring rendition. I got to stop doing that. I've almost, with my performance, I've almost tricked you into thinking that was a good poem. I almost did. But it's not, you know, and in fact, you have to say at the start and again at the end that it is a poem, or else you would have no idea that it was a poem. Like, that's a good indication that it's a bad poem is if when you post it and show people, you have to tell them, you have to say, "Here's a poem." Because with a good poem or really just a poem, a real poem, you don't have to tell people it's a poem. They'll get it when they read it. Because the thing is, if you're not told it's a poem and you read that, you think that you're reading just like a random assortment of YouTube comments. Or maybe you might think that that you're you know, drunk or having a stroke. But no, that was a poem. A poem that if it made you cry at all, it should only make you cry because you want it to stop. But it just goes on and refuses to stop. So let me just make a few observations here. First of all, this may be better titled Non Sequitur, the poem, because it's full of sentences where the second part of the sentence has nothing to do with the first. For example, "I just got a notification that my student loan payments are starting up again and my phone isn't charged." That's one sentence. But how are those two things related? And what is he saying? Is he saying that he got a notification that his student loan payments are starting up again and he also got a notification that his phone isn't charged? Or is he saying that he got a notification that student loans are starting up again and also on a separate note, his phone isn't charged? Never mind the fact that if the phone isn't charged, then how are you getting notifications about anything in the first place? The bigger question is, why did you put those two entirely separate thoughts into one sentence without even a comma to distinguish them? In a similar fashion, he tells us that fascists keep winning primaries for both parties, and I think I gained a few pounds. So did he gain a few pounds because of the fascists? When he goes to the doctor and the doctor says, "You've gained 14 pounds, what happened?" Does he respond, "Oh, well, you know, fascists have been winning primaries"? He probably does offer that as an excuse, but still it's a non sequitur. And of course, the greatest non sequitur line in the whole thing is the bit about a guy who wants to be punk rock on a subway, but he's not wearing a mask, and that makes the writer want to steal batteries. So we have three disconnected thoughts in one sentence, right? Like punk rock, mask, stealing batteries. None of that have anything, nothing to do with each other. And it leaves us only with a question of why his anger towards the guy without a mask would make him want to steal batteries, and why batteries specifically. The only sentence in the whole thing that makes sense is the one where he says the CDC just announced there are no more speed limits on highways and I think Ativan is finally hitting. In that case, we can see the connection. You know, he begins by telling us about some totally imaginary situation where the CDC is abolishing speed limits, I guess. And he ends by telling us that he's under the influence of psychotropic drugs, which explains the hallucinations. So that part makes sense. Although, as a side note, if the CDC did abolish speed limits, it would be the first worthwhile thing they've ever done. But that's beside the point. The main point is that this writer has barely managed to compose a single legitimate and coherent sentence, let alone an entire poem. And so I must once again point out that this is not poetry. You cannot just write a series of run-on sentences, slap a title on it, and call it poetry. Poetry has rhythm, structure, meaning. I'll put it another way. If this is poetry, then everything that's ever been written is poetry. Literally every paragraph ever composed about anything in any context is poetry if this is poetry. An IKEA instruction manual is poetry. An online recipe for lasagna is poetry. In fact, those things are much better poetry than this, especially the lasagna. Like what I'm saying right now is poetry, if the thing I'm talking about is also poetry. Because poetry is everything, which means that poetry is nothing. When someone calls themselves a poet in this case, all they mean is that they have the capacity for human speech. Someone is a poet because they have said or written something, anything, literally anything. That's what poetry has become, because poetry no longer exists in our culture. But this poem also represents something else aside from the death of poetry as an art form. It also represents, of course, this modern desire to feel persecuted at all costs. Because the poem, to the extent that it's anything at all, is just one long series of complaints. Yet the complaints, like so many complaints these days, vacillate between totally imaginary and incredibly petty. He says that his cousin has been rendered crippled and paraplegic from COVID, which of course didn't happen. He says that the CDC abolished speed limits, which also didn't happen, unfortunately. He says that fascists are winning primaries, which hasn't happened. He says he has to avoid the plague, but there is no plague. And he says that he has to stop a genocide, yet at no point during this man's daily life is he ever confronted with a genocide, much less one that he has to or can or would even attempt to stop. The only reality-based complaints in the poem are that the rent has gone up, he's gained a few pounds, it's warm outside, the farmer's market has a subpar supply of apples, and he has to do his laundry. That's what's really happening in this guy's life. It's what he's really suffering from. It's a bit warm, he's a bit fat, he doesn't like the apples at the farmer's market, and he has to do his laundry. And when you boil it down to like that, to its essential parts, you see that actually, you know, this guy has it pretty easy. Like, you know, everybody on earth has some complaints. You cannot live a life utterly free of hardship. So if those are your hardships, you have it about as easy as a human being can reasonably expect. You are quite comfortably in the top 1% of easy lives. 99% of humans on earth have a harder life than you. And almost none of them are writing poems about it. In fact, your bad poetry, if anything, is only adding to the overall net suffering in the world. You have just made everyone's lives a little bit worse by inflicting crappy poetry on them. I could write a poem about the suffering I experienced from reading that poem. In fact, I already have. As established, everything I've said already is a poem by default. That's what happens when you lower the artistic bar to this extent. And that is why Vinay Krishnan and everybody who complimented his poem, all of whom should be legally disqualified from voting and then deported to a moon of Jupiter, are all today canceled. That'll do it for the show today. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow. Have a great day. Godspeed.